This past week, I went home for Canadian Thanksgiving, or in my world, Thanksgiving. And on Monday morning, on Thanksgiving, which was as beautiful an October day as you could ask for, I asked my parents and my brother to come for a drive with me along the Niagara Parkway, following the Niagara River up to Niagara Falls. And having grown up just 20 minutes from Niagara Falls, you could imagine that it would become easy to take the falls for granted, to kind of get used to them. But even though I have been to the falls innumerable times, every time I see the mist rising over the water and witness the sheer force and volume with which that water tumbles over this cliff face, I am astounded. And it's even more impressive when you know some of the stats. So here is a geography lesson typical of what I got in grade school. The Niagara River flows north from the higher Lake Erie to the lower Lake Ontario, and along the way it meets a cliff, the Niagara Escarpment. The river branches out a bit at this cliff, with about 90% of the water going over the Horseshoe Falls in Canada, and a dam rerouting about 10% to hydroelectric facilities, and then the Bridle and American Falls on the U.S. side. And on an average day in spring or summer, more than 6 million cubic feet of water fall over these falls every minute. 6 million cubic feet every minute. And the rocks and salts along these cliff faces are dissolved by the force of that water at a rate of 60 tons per minute. Which means that the falls are actually moving backward. Over the last 10,000-ish years, the falls have moved approximately 6.8 miles upstream. About 4,200 years ago, which is interestingly enough right around the time of Abraham, so there's that context. While Abraham is walking around doing his thing, the Niagara Falls are receding along the river, and they encounter an ancient pre-glacial riverbed that runs almost perpendicular to where the river was going. And that riverbed had been filled with loose rock and sediment over centuries. And when the falls met this riverbed, the water loosened up all of that rock and sediment, and so the water then fills that riverbed and turns 90 degrees just about, creating the whirlpool at the bottom of that. The falls are now eroding this cliff face at a rate of 1 foot per year, which means that in another 50,000 years, Niagara Falls will no longer exist. That to me is just bonkers, right? Like, that is so crazy. It's so much water. It is so much force changing the lay of the land over time. It is amazing. And that could be where the amazement ends. For a lot of people, it is where the amazement ends. Look at these waterfalls. Look at this giant sequoia. Look at that vast, seemingly endless desert, at this magnificent sunset. Isn't our planet amazing? Isn't it a wonder how it all holds together? But the real wonder, says Psalm 104, is that everything holds together. The sequoia grows, the desert animal keeps its cool, the Niagara River goes where it will, because God has made it so. While Psalm 104 includes a great deal of creation imagery, this is not a psalm about creation, but about the Creator. Psalm 104 is one long psalm of praise of God's power and sovereignty in his world, using our experience of creation as a summons to that praise. As Walter Brueggemann puts it, the psalm invites the self of the speaker to come face to face with the wonder of creation and with the Creator God who orders and guarantees that life-giving wonder. And so the psalm begins with a litany imagining God's relationship to the different parts of creation. His clothes are light. His sleeping quarters are the skies above. His transportation is a chariot of clouds pulled along by horses of wind as fire leaps ahead of him to announce his coming. It's vivid imagery. But oddly enough, I think it leaves us perhaps more unable to actually imagine this God. These images speak to the magnitude, the bigness, the unknownness of God. A God who rides the clouds is something wholly other from us. When face to face with Niagara Falls and unable to comprehend its magnificence, how much more can we not comprehend the God who pours that water out as though from a glass? And as we're contemplating then God's majesty and sovereignty over creation, I think this psalm leads us to a pretty pressing question. Because while Niagara Falls might at least follow some order and design, a lot of what we experience in creation seems more chaotic than organized, more uncontrollable than fixed and ordered, more threatening than delightful. I experience a lot of tension when I read Psalm 104. This was a sermon that was kind of a hard one to write, because clearly, creation does not always work together the way it ought to. God's chariot clouds sometimes bring with them dark and dangerous storms. His horses of wind can whip themselves up into twisters or hurricanes or sandstorms, causing immense damage. His ministers of flame leap and dance their way over huge swaths of land, destroying everything in their path. And the waters that he orders into their streams and rivers and oceans sometimes spill out over the earth and cover the land and everything on it. So what do we make of this when we read Psalm 104? We can't just ignore these things when they happen. We can't pretend that everything in creation is hunky-dory. So are we to doubt God's sovereignty? Or is God to blame when things in creation go awry? Well, I think we make sense of this the way we make sense of all suffering in the world, which is to say that on the one hand, we don't make sense of it very well. So much is a mystery, and on this side of the new creation, we cannot fully know the ways of God. But there are things we do know. We know that while God is in control, his world, this world, is also still beset by evil and sin and suffering. That Satan still holds people and places in his clutches, still seeks to destroy and create chaos whenever and wherever possible. And so while we trust that Satan's power is tenuous and one day will be destroyed forever, we yet live in an age where the spirits of this world wreak havoc in creation. We also know that we are a part of the problem, that we make decisions or are in fact thoughtless about our actions that harm the planet. Intentional or not, the way we live, our desire for comfort, for immediacy, our lackadaisical response to waste, our penchant for excess, is causing systems in creation to shift, contributing to a rise in some of the unpredictable, chaotic behavior we experience. And yet we also know that even though there are parts of creation that feel chaotic, the vast majority of creation is not. Much like we tend to focus on all the horrible things people do and forget just how much is good and beautiful and right, I think it's also easy for us to get caught up in the chaotic and disastrous parts of weather systems and creation, and to lose sight of just how incredible this creation is and how it works together in harmony, this part relying on that for its flourishing. So often, I think we take all of this for granted, because we only notice creation sometimes when it goes horribly wrong or when it's simply spectacular, like a glorious sunset or Niagara Falls. But what a miracle it is that leaves know exactly when to change color, and that wildflowers attract bees who spread pollen, which creates more wildflowers. That a bear can survive for months asleep, barely breathing. Barely breathing. I just got that. How unimaginably magnificent that a whole grove of aspen trees is in fact one single organism, all sharing the same root system, or that water evaporates and then cools and then falls back to the earth before it evaporates again, nourishing the earth in a continuous cycle. Psalm 104, this creation litany, does not negate the fact that bad things happen in creation. But I think what it does is call us to pay attention to these things rightly. To not only look for the bad and the chaotic, but also to see everything that is beautiful and good and lovely and ordered. The psalmist reminds us that God is bigger, stronger, more powerful than the fiercest storm, and yet is intimately involved in his creation. He sets the water in its course. He feeds the animals from his hand. He provides a resting place for the birds. He quiets the storm with a word. The psalm begs of us a different question, not how can bad things happen when God is sovereign over creation? But rather, how much is good because God is sovereign over creation? And so the psalm reorients us. It reframes the way in which we look at the world, calling us to see not just that which causes us to fear and despair and be anxious, but to fix our eyes also on every blessing of beauty and order and goodness, so that as we wonder in the beauty of creation, we learn to trust and to respond in praise. Because this is the ultimate invitation of this psalm. It is a call to live in praise. Bless the Lord, O my soul. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have being. And again, this might strike us as a little tone deaf given the state of the natural world in some places. But this act of praising our Creator God does not mean we live with a cavalier ignorance of the challenges we face. It doesn't mean we stick our heads in the sand or put on rose-colored glasses as if everything about the climate and increasing storms and catastrophic weather systems weren't a real problem. Living in praise of the Creator rather calls us to action for the right reasons. It orients our lives and our choices rightly. And it does so in three ways. First, through praise, through joy, through delight, we image the God who takes delight in his creation, who rejoices in all his works. We echo the words God has uttered from the very beginning that this is very good. And so through praise, we live into our truest selves, seeking and naming goodness and beauty in all corners of creation. Second, through this praise and joy, we perform, we declare the truth that God is in control. One of the more intriguing verses in this psalm refers to Leviathan. And in other places in Scripture, like Psalm 74 or Job 41, Leviathan is named as one of the monsters of chaos and evil that God overcomes and overpowers. But in Psalm 104, scholar Elizabeth Webb notes that Leviathan is just another creature that delights in the world that God has made, that its purpose in the created order is to sport in the sea. So she writes, the joy with which God creates is reflected in the playfulness of the sea's most dreaded beast. Thus, joy triumphs over chaos in a way that raw power cannot, by winning it over. There is much fear and anxiety and despair about the state of the planet right now, and some of it is merited. But we are a people who believe in a God who met death and transformed it, who encounters evil and upends it, who sees chaos and reorders it, and does so with and through joy and beauty and laughter and life. And so our very act of praise of God for the sustaining order by which he created the world is transformative. Brueggemann writes, Israel's doxology about order counters the felt threat of disorder that is everywhere palpable in the world. In a contemporary context that feels out of control in chaotic disorder, this affirmation of creation offers a profound pastoral claim in a society beset by acute anxiety. And with that hope and that assurance, then, we come to the third aspect of living in praise, namely, that in that praise, we are able to join God in the work of stewardship. This psalm reminds us that God is intimately involved in creation, which means he is intimately involved with us, which means, says Brueggemann, that God's providence does not play out in otherworldly ways separate from us, but that God's providential care for the world is also enacted through the everyday miracles of mission and volunteerism by those who love God. So the psalm invites us to care for creation, to be good stewards of creation, not from a place of fear and anxiety, but because we seek to glorify God the Creator through our words and actions. Verse 34 offers the whole psalm up to God. May my meditation be pleasing to him, for I rejoice in the Lord. And so the psalm calls us to offer everything we do to the Lord. As we engage in his creation, whether we're doing so for recreation purposes or in scientific study or as part of our work and trade or simply for pure aesthetic enjoyment, are we doing so for the glory of God? Are we doing so in praise of the Creator? Psalm 104 ultimately says that ours is a duty of doxology. The psalm does not say that it is our duty to save the planet. It is not our duty to keep the chaos at bay. It is not our duty to live in fear and anxiety to show that we care about the planet. It is our duty to praise the Creator, to live in trust and joy, Because if we are doing that, if our words and our actions seek to honor and glorify our unimaginable, magnificent, sovereign God and give thanks for his intricate and beautiful creation, that true praise will lead us to make choices that reflect God's own heart for his creation and a desire to see this world flourish in every corner. So go do all of the things to care for the planet. Eat less beef. Discard single-use plastics. Fly less. Demand change at the public policy level. But as you do this, when you feel anxious or discouraged or afraid for the future, read Psalm 104. Be reminded that God does hold this whole world in his hands, that he is intimately involved in his creation, and his ways might be mysterious and unknown to us, but they are good. And in that knowledge and that hope, carry on caring for this beautiful, vast, intricate, astonishing world that we might live in praise of the one who created it. Would you pray with me?